Aloha, welcome to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
Slashing a safety net, Hawaii is bracing for what could be massive cuts under President Donald Trump's proposed budget. What many people know is the food stamp program could be in line for a major redesign. We talk with the head of the Department of Human Services about what could be in store. And going beyond the walls of the University of Hawaii Medical School, epigenetics is the subject. The living laboratory is Waianae. We focus on genes and the environment. We spotlight a research project on a farm, and thanks to help from HMSA, it's extending its reach into the community.
A veteran of the Mars Island, Hawaii Island Mars Habitat celebrates the value of STEM education for girls, and blues troubadour Andy Kimball keeps the acoustic guitar fingerstyle tradition alive. It's Thursday, February 15th, and the conversation starts right after the latest headline.
It's called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Most people know it as the food stamp program, which helps to feed the hungry. Here in Hawaii, more than 85,000 households rely on the extra help every month to put food on the table, and more than 60% of that goes to help children and the elderly. The director of the Hawaii Department of Human Services, Pangash Bano, joins us for some frank talk about the impacts to needy families and the potential cost to the state, and whether this new idea of doling out boxes of food called harvest boxes will work in our island state.
They are proposing this blue ribbon approach where there are going to be boxes that are going to be given to eligible recipients of SNAP. And we're going to continue to keep an eye on the developments because, as you know now, that it is 100% federally funded benefit and exclusively all eligibility is based on federal rules and regulations. So we would have to keep an eye. And if there are any cuts to the program, it is definitely going to have impact on State of Hawaii. And if state has to find money to make up the difference if any cuts are made, it is going to be very difficult for the state because we would have to then make choices, not only as the executive agency, but also the legislature. We will all have to make choices as to what is the right thing to do for the residents of Hawaii and how we are going to prioritize when it would come to food or cash benefits or medical assistance. We would have to start to make those decisions if states would have to pay some share of the cost associated with these benefits. There may be cuts to our TANF program, which is temporary assistance for needy families. Anything can, we're keeping an eye on all developments at the federal level because as you also know from various reports that 64.5% of our budget is based on federal funds. It's a pretty large number because our current budget is at $3.5 billion. And 64.5% is federal funds.
So what kinds of talks are underway right now within the administration to deal with the potential shortfall?
What we are doing is we know exactly what our current level of funding is with state and federal funds. We also know what our current participation rate for various programs is as well. And we are keeping an eye on all congressional developments and president's budget. We have just started to really pour over and with a close eye on all the numbers because we do not have the actual numbers crunched yet that what impact it's going to have on Hawaii on our programs. But we will get there pretty shortly because we just started the review of President's proposed budget because details are not available at this point for us to really look deep into it.
How soon do you think we'll have those numbers?
I have no idea. But I think pretty shortly because they would have to be made available. So because our congressional delegation is definitely going to ask for the impact statement as to what impact it's going to have on Hawaii. So we will be ready for it. I'm not sure. I cannot give you exact data as to when we will have the complete details.
And what's your takeaway on the proposal for these harvest boxes, and how would that work here in Hawaii? Do we have a system that could, easily ramp up to be able to do something like this if it was required?
I do not believe that we have the system that we can ramp up very quickly to provide these harvest boxes, because the current system, as you know, is based on electronic transactions. It is electronic benefit transfer card that we issue. It is required by federal law. We issue it to all our recipients. And this money actually ends up going on that EBT card, and that particular SNAP amount that goes onto that card can only be used for SNAP-related purchases that are pre-approved by the federal government. U.S. Department of Agriculture pre-approves it. For example, you can't buy toiletries with SNAP money. You can't buy alcohol, tobacco, and other things that are not authorized using your SNAP benefit, using that electronic benefit transfer card. So you can only buy approved grocery items, the nutritious things that you can buy. You can't buy prepared meals, hot meals, and other things, because the goal is to actually have you buy and prepare food based on the nutritional guidelines that we provide to our clients as well through our nutrition outreach and education that we provide. So it's going to be a totally different system of delivering these benefits. If that is what becomes the law of the land, then we would have to totally change the way we do business. And I think it will all be transitioned over a period of time, because federal government would have to change the rules and regulations, and also the means of delivering this is also going to change, because it's not going to be an electronic transfer anymore. The amount is not going to go to the families. It would be actual food items or commodities that'll be going to the recipients. It's a totally different system, in my humble opinion.
And logistically, though, because we are an island state, and we've got varying numbers of people that are on this program, just administratively, I could just see how that could be a nightmare.
We are not set up to deliver such a program. We would have to literally review what the requirements are going to be and what resources we would need, and figure out our strategy at that point as to how we are going to deliver that. That would mean that people would have to come physically to pick up those boxes. If that becomes the law, then we would have to adapt, and we will adapt, because it's such a vital program to literally avoid people slipping further into poverty. We would have to figure out a way to implement whatever the federal law is going to be.
Right, but in the smaller counties where maybe you might not have the infrastructure, and I don't even know if we could even do that really here on Oahu very easily, just because of the complexity in setting up such a system. And then it's not like you can just drive across state lines to deliver, whatever it is, the greens or the canned goods. It just could be a logistic nightmare.
I totally agree with you. We are not set up to deliver commodities, canned goods, or packages of food to people, whether it's bread, eggs, cereals, grains, sugar, whatever it is. We are not set up. There is no infrastructure for such delivery. Even if you look at partnerships, if say, for example, they even allow for partnerships with the community agencies like food banks on different islands, they are not set up either. And plus, the thing is, currently the way law is written, food benefits, the eligibility for SNAP and allocation or issuance of benefit amounts is exclusively a domain of Merit Civil Service. That means you have to be a civil services employee to do that, because that's how the federal law is written. So if we cannot enter into partnerships where others can do eligibility and issue benefits, but if the strategy at the federal level is going to change, and nonprofits and others can become trusted partners, and these things can be delivered through those organizations, then there is at least some infrastructure is there across the state that can be leveraged. But if it remains a domain of Merit Civil Service, we are not set up to do this. It's impossible, because we also have to do all the public assistance programs dealing with cash, medical, and child care. Our staff is already fully allocated for different other types of benefits that we issue. And if we need to also now now provide these boxes or bags of food or other things. We are not set up for it, because that's why it is such an easier job for us, is to issue benefits on the electronic benefit transfer card, and they can go to different grocery stores to get it done, unless the, somehow one of the strategies would be that this can be translated into boxes at the grocery stores who will participate, retailers will participate in this particular program, then it is a totally different story and a strategy and a tact. But we don't know what the details are. We'll continue to monitor, and we'll have a better idea as to where this is going. It's going to be a reduction across the board, and it would mean that lesser amount is available, and if there is a cap on the benefit, which it may turn out to be, it's going to be a problem. You know, we may not be able to serve all the people we are serving today, because there is no cap on the SNAP program. So whoever applies and is found to be eligible, and benefits are issued to that particular household or individual. But if there is going to be a cap, then that means that once we reach that upper limit, we won't be able to take any other applications, new applications for benefits. It could entirely be that scenario.
Wow. So not only the prospect of less money, but fewer people being served.
Entirely possible. If there is any reduction in the SNAP program, that would be the effect.
Pankaj Bano is the director of Hawaii's Department of Human Services. That is the agency responsible for administering the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program locally. We'll have links to the local SNAP website and the administration's proposed budget posted on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, selling the excitement of STEM education for young girls. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of an endemic Hawaiian bird that can be found high on the slopes of Mauna Loa. In 2016, about 75 pairs of the endangered bird lived on Hawaii Island and made their nests in lava rock burrows. Parents take turns incubating a single egg and forage for food in very distant places. And even though these birds live in isolation, they weren't safe from our statewide nomadic house pets. We're talking cats. In 2013, construction crews went up to the habitats, found around 8,000 to 10,000 feet above sea level, and they began constructing a 6-foot-high fence that protects a 600-acre area. The seabirds spent much of their lives at sea and come to land only during breeding season. The fluffy chicks hatch in August and remain in their burrows until November, when they fledge or take their first flight out to sea. Adults, eggs, and chicks are extremely vulnerable to predators throughout the long breeding season, as all activity occurs on the ground. Today, we're looking for their name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Those native birds we just told you about aren't all that's happening on the slopes of Mauna Loa. Later today, an international crew will enter a geodesic dome at the 8,000-foot level to experience a simulation of life on Mars. Dr. Kim Binstead of the University of Hawaii at Manoa Information and Computer Sciences Department is the principal investigator for that habitat study, known as Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, or High Seas. She's also a passionate advocate of science, technology, engineering, and math education for girls. She'll be the keynote speaker for the Sacred Hearts Academy Science Symposium for girls in grades 5 through 8. We spoke about the all-too-prevalent social conditioning that keeps girls away from science.
Well, part of it is removing some of the discouragement. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of pressures on girls to conform to gender stereotypes, and that includes not going into STEM, you know. So, you know, part of it is right from the early stages, let girls know that they're capable of doing whatever they want, showing them the excitement of STEM topics, you know, the excitement of what science shows us about the universe, about what you can do when you build things using engineering techniques or even Lego blocks. Mm-hmm. All of these things help.
Does that call for a maybe more interactive way of presenting that information?
I think most children benefit from interactive learning, but I think that a lot of the toys and interactive techniques that encourage people to go into STEM tend to be directed at boys. You know, the construction toys, science kits, even butterfly collecting, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
These tend to be aimed at boys.
Yeah, I had an erector set, a chemistry set, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And they weren't marketed, this is a long time ago, as girl toys.
Right, right. And there's more to marketing something as a girl toy than making it pink. That tends to be the approach. We'll take the chemistry set and we'll make it pink. And instead of calling it a chemistry set, we'll make it a perfume creation kit or something like that.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, there's more to it than that.
Part of this, you know, the overarching thing is that, you know, girls are sort of patronized by that. Did you feel that when you were a kid?
You know, I think I was spared a lot of that. My parents growing up were very into, you know, having me playing outside, having me use my hands to build things. They were very, very open to these things. There were a couple times when there was explicit patronization. So I remember in high school, I did a little computer quiz that was supposed to help you think about what your career would be. And it came up with, you know, scientist and doctor and things like that. But the job counselor said, "Whoa, you typed that really quickly. You should probably be a secretary."
Really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I might expect that from the 1950s, but yeah. This is a lot more recently than that.
Yeah, I thought that would have been early 80s. Yeah.
You know, because by that time, the whole thing of diverting girls into home ec, as it was called, you know, basically to be a homemaker, to be a wife, to, you know, have dinner hot for him when he came home, that had mostly gone away by the 80s.
Well, there was still home ec at my school.
Really?
And when, you know, the technology classes for girls were really aimed at secretarial skills. So I've lost my shorthand, but I was really good at it at one point. And using computers was all about typing letters for the boss.
Well, that stuff's dug in pretty deep, Kim. Mm. So how do you go about, you know, selling science, technology, you know, STEM education?
Well, part of it, I think, is making sure that everyone has a better idea of what a scientist is. You know, if you do a Google search, an image search for scientist, you see a bunch of people in lab coats.
White coats,
you know, the lab glasses on, holding a test tube with something green bubbling in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure there's a scientist out there listening now who goes, yep, that's me. But it's not 99% of scientists. Scientists include geologists who spend their time outside, you know, marine biologists who spend a lot of time on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all sorts of different, you know, looks to a scientist, and it includes men and women. So you want to make sure that broader vision of what a scientist is out there and is accessible. Similarly for engineering, if you do a Google image search on engineer, you get someone in a yellow hard hat with plans in their hand standing on a construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's much more to engineering than that.
Well, at the same time, when you're first in the educational path that a lot of us take, these aspects of science don't get that exciting until you know a little bit about it. You know, there's that, you got to have that first year of getting some grounding in the information, and then the exciting stuff can manifest itself. But is there a bit of a hurdle at the beginning to be overcome?
Well, I think that, you know, there's sort of two pieces to science, or the many pieces, but science itself is a process. So I think it's really important, rather than just teaching a bunch of facts and calling that science, is to teach the process. It's a way of learning about the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really fun right from the beginning. You say, okay, well, how do we figure out this thing mm-hmm. that we're familiar with? One exercise I like to do with the kids is I give them a bunch of eggs. And I say, okay, some of these eggs have been boiled, some haven't.
Hmm.
I want you to figure out a technique for telling them apart without breaking the egg open. You can break eggs open in the process of developing your technique to test your ideas,
mm-hmm.
But in the end, I want you to come up with a technique for telling which one is which without breaking them open. And that's fun.
Yeah.
You know, they spend a lot of time, you know, weighing them and throwing them and then breaking them open to see if they were right. But that whole process is the scientific process.
Then the scientific method, you know, as a very proven method for finding out if something is true or not, verification, it's a little bit under fire. I mean, the scientific method has shown us global warming is a reality. And yet we're running into an awful lot of climate science denial and an anti-science movement. How do you get around that?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I think there's always been a bit of anti-intellectualism always been a part of American culture, and it's rolling a little bit harder than it used to right now. But mm-hmm. I think it's always been there, and part of the way to get around that is to maybe show that science isn't just ivory tower intellect.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how you understand your universe around you. It really isn't just what happens in laboratories and on the space station. It's a way of thinking about the world.
Are you encouraged by the citizen science movement? You know, recruiting people to go out and gather in surveys and you know, check the amount of shells they find on the beach, that kind of thing. Have basically amateurs getting into the act and contributing information to more trained scientists.
Oh, yeah, I think it's wonderful. I think anytime you've got people participating in science, there's automatically a buy-in there. You come to understand, you know, what makes meaningful data and how is that data going to change how we understand the world. For what it's worth, I also think it's great when people participate as subjects in science. So, you know, if you sign up as a subject in a diet study run by one of the hospitals or something,
mm-hmm.
It's a way of experiencing science from the inside without necessarily being a trained scientist.
But it sort of going back to the whole process of bringing girls in, it sounds as if what we're talking about is really just finding ways to make it lively, participatory, interesting, regardless of gender.
Well, right. And I think people talk about role models. In part was the image thing I was talking about earlier. People need to be, in order to think of yourself in a job, you need to be able to imagine yourself in that
mm-hmm.
job. And part of that is image. You know, what would I look like if I were a scientist?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the messaging girls get about that is really off-putting. You know, you'll never get out. You'll sit in a dark lab all day. You're stuck in a white coat, you know. And none of that is really true. A lot of science is very very active, very social, very dynamic, and a lot of fun.
It's been exciting for you, right?
Oh, yeah. I have a great time. My science projects are a little off the norm, too.
But that's – you're entitled, right?
Well, yeah. So we're trying to figure out what it takes to put a group of people on Mars and to do deep exploration missions. And so that's, I think, important as well, is to both give the big goal – you know, here, in my case, we're trying to put people on Mars and bring them safely home again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then there's all the detailed stuff you have to do in order to make that happen. So it really helps you stay interested in some of the minutiae when you know that it's serving this greater goal.
Dr. Kim Binstead of the University of Hawaii Manoa Information and Computer Sciences Department will be the featured speaker at Sacred Hearts Academy's 24th Science Symposium for Girls this Saturday from 7:45 to 11:30 in the morning. You can go to the Conversation's Facebook page for a link to the Science Symposium page where you can register online for free.
It's time now for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Governor David Ibe is offering to offset increases in rent faced by residents in a Kaka'ako senior housing project. But if he does it for this facility, what about others soon to be in the same predicament? Anita Hofschneider joins us with a story about rising costs for the elderly in senior housing. Hi, Anita.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell us about this. How's he going to figure this all out?
Well, you know, for the residents of Nale Hulu Kupuna, which is a senior housing project in Kaka'ako, the future is looking a lot brighter than it was a few weeks ago when they got a letter from the developer who recently bought the complex telling them that their rent was going to go up. And the developer said he would subsidize them for up to a year, but that he couldn't guarantee what would happen after that. And so a lot of seniors were really anxious and wondering what was going on. And so Governor Ige's announcement the other day basically said that he would find some state subsidies to help them for the next 15 years. And these subsidies would only go to current tenants, but essentially would help make sure that they wouldn't be displaced.
Right. But what about other projects that are going to be finding the rents going up?
That's a big question. And so, you know, we've seen rents rising, you know, all across Hawaii. And in senior housing projects, they've been increasing in places as far apart as the west side of Oahu and in Manoa. And you've seen rents going up, ranging from 2% increases to as much as 10% increases in these projects. And that's affecting the seniors there. You know, for example, in Manoa, they're going to have a meeting soon organized by Councilwoman Kobayashi to talk to EAH Housing, which is a developer there, to figure out what's going on and you know, get more information to the seniors. And so one thing that the governor announcement possibly opens up, you know, related to Kaka'ako is whether there'll be more money available for some of these other projects.
Right, because you are wondering, well, is this just a short-term fix and something to use because it's an election year and he's, you know, trying to get keep his seat?
It is an election year, and he's facing a tough race this year, and it does not look good for him if seniors are getting displaced in Kaka'ako, because as you may know, when he was running against former Governor Abercrombie, he really criticized the luxury high rises going up in Kaka'ako and made affordable housing a key part of his campaign. And so now, it's a big question whether or not this is just related to his campaign or what this would really mean in a broader sense of what's going to happen to seniors all across the state.
That's right, because the city did try to do a big push to have private sector come in and take over and I think rehab a lot of these subsidized housing projects in Honolulu, and that fell apart. I think it was started under Mayor Carlisle and then was under Mayor Kirk Caldwell. But that didn't happen. And so at some point, somebody's going to have to pay for these improvements. And, you can just see it being passed on to the residents.
Well, the developer actually did receive about $3 million, I believe, from the city and county. And it's part of this new affordable housing fund that as part of the mayor's affordable housing strategy. And so there is a city investment in this project for rehabilitating the facility, which is kind of getting old and aging and is in need of some improvements. And so in this case, the city is actually working with the developer on this as well. So the city has a role.
Right. So a big question mark as to what happens in Kaka'ako with other projects that, the residents might be seeing these huge increases.
At least I know that some residents in Manoa are watching this carefully. They're wondering, what does this mean for them? And I'm sure that residents in other projects, across the state are wondering the same.
All right. Thanks, Anita.
Thank you.
That was reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's reality check from our partners at Civil Beat.
On February 24th, HPR's Atherton Studio is the setting for a rare rhythm summit, featuring three of Hawaii's premier musicians, Kenny Endo, Noel Okimoto, and Dean Taba. Get your tickets for this evening of world music and jazz fusion in the Atherton on the 24th at hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Epigenetics. Heard of it? What's it all about? Well, rates of diabetes, obesity, and alcoholism run high among Native Hawaiians. We look at how a researcher is using his family ties and inspiration to give back to his hometown and hopefully change a community's health habits for the better. We sat down with Alika Mauna Kea to understand more about the relationship between genes and the environment.
It was through our previous work in the Department of Native Hawaiian Health that really recognized that Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders experience some of the worst health conditions and outcomes in the state. So, for example, diabetes and obesity is about three times more prevalent in Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders than the general population in Hawaii. In addition to that, we also experience these diseases at an earlier age than others, on average about 10 years. So part of our mission in the department is to understand why this is so that we can ultimately restore health equity. So I'm excited to talk about this project that's started this summer, which plays a small role in addressing these health needs.
So you're partnering with a number of groups to get into your research. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
So it's sponsored in part by the HMSA Foundation. The study is a collaboration between my lab and Dr. Ruben Juarez, who is an expert in social network analysis and game theory in the Department of Economics at the University of Hawaii Manoa, and also Ma'o Organic Farms, which is part of the Waianae Community Development Redevelopment Corporation.
And so you have created this unique program. Tell us about where you want this project to go.
Sure. Well, first, the purpose of the program is to determine the impact of a community-developed Aina-based program in Waianae on the health of participants in the program and that of their families and friends. We hope that in the long term, it will help to reduce and eliminate health disparities in Hawaii. And we realize it takes a multifaceted approach to address this significant problem. Not just one person or one organization can address this. And we really see our project as one way to empower the community to really play an active role in improving the community health in Waianae and throughout the state. We feel that addressing the health needs of our community is really a shared kuleana.
And so you have this program with Ma'o Farms, and the way I understand it, you've got like an internship program. Mm-hmm. You get the kids from the community to come in and try and, what, change their behaviors?
Well, Ma'o's been around for about 15 years now, and they've created an amazing educational program that empowers the youth of the community to be more engaged in their own lives and to have more control of their own lives and to seek out opportunities that they would never have otherwise. That includes leadership building skills as well as working with teams and understanding about the environment, how it's important to them and their lives and their families, how it can affect their health, the types of nutrition that they choose to partake in, or other things that can affect their health and their environment. So they're really empowered by this information in Ma'o's educational program. And they actually came to us asking how, telling us some stories, some amazing stories of how that program changed their lives, changed their behaviors, also influenced the decision-making of their family members in eating healthier or having access to foods or why they do what they do. Essentially, Ma'o, their interns and their experiences really inspired the creation of this study.
Okay, give us an example.
So, for example, one of the interns who's been there for more than a year now has told us that her refrigerator has changed when her family learned that she started in her internship on Ma'o. And we asked her to explain that a little bit more, and she said, well, you know, my mom and dad decided to stock the refrigerator up with produce, vegetables, and fruits, more so than they ever did before. And this was because they realized that she was working in Ma'o Organic Farms. And so that's changed, impacted not only her decision personally, but how it influenced her parents' decisions on nutrition. And so we think that this impact that Mount Ojai has on education and really guiding youth along the education pipeline can influence their choices that affects health, not only their personal health, but the health of those around them, their families and friends. And so this study is really about answering a few questions. How is the health of an individual influenced by others around them? And can this be modified by a community-based organization like Ma'o that focuses on education and environmental sustainability?
So walk us through. So you get an intern, and they sign up for the program, and then how do you track their behavior and the physiological changes that that happen?
Sure. So we use a survey format to gather information from participants about their family background, social economics, education, nutrition, stress, anxiety, as well as certain behaviors. These are self-reported and can be done online. We also perform a simple health assessment measuring height and weight, blood pressure, and hemoglobin A1C as a measure of glycemic control because we're really trying to understand diabetes risk in this population. And finally, we provide participants with an in-home stool sample collection kit where they can send us their sample and we analyze their gut microbiome composition using genetic sequencing. So we'll be examining how these measures may change over time, about a year from now, amongst the participants and their close family and friends enrolled in the study.
So talk about that, because you not only get the intern, but then you also get the folks that are close to them that might agree to be involved in this study?
Right. So we'd like to learn about how their the experiences that the interns have and their behaviors or choices and might actually influence the people around them and not only their choices but how it actually physically affects them and whether actually they can have shared environments including certain types of nutrition, certain types of behaviors that are shared that could impact their health. And we're trying to measure that in different ways. And one of the interesting ways of looking at this in sort of a novel approach, and no one's really done it here in Hawaii before, is looking at the impact of these types of educational programs on overall health, but also how it might actually influence the gut microbiome composition, which is an important component of health.
And so you've got a core group that started out with you. What's the goal? How large do you of a sampling do you have now, and where do you want to grow it?
We have currently 80 individuals enrolled in the initial study, and we hope to get about 350 individuals enrolled by the end of the year. And we hope also that this could be extended even further. And the goal is really to understand how the interns on their experiences on the farm and what they learned and how they make decisions impact individuals around them, and not only the decision-making of those individuals around them, but how it impacts their actual physical health. And we hope that that could be used as a model to learn from that other community organizations' programs might be developed around.
You must be really gratified because this is your community. You're from Waianae, mm-hmm. and you mentioned to me earlier that your grandmother was kind of inspirational in kind of leading you along this path. But you're actually seeing positive changes where you live.
Right. And I think it was really my upbringing in my great-grandmother, Catherine Monica, was really the matriarch of my family. I grew up in a four-generation household in Nanakuli homestead. And it was her that taught us that health, that the environment actually really influences our health. And she taught us, for example, she said that if you take care of the land will take care of you. And I think that's, as a scientist, this simple phrase makes a lot of sense. We really are part of nature and a product of the environment, as my work in epigenetics is reinforcing. And maintaining a healthy environment will, I think, help all of us live healthier lives. And I believe our ancestors, our kupuna, really not only understood this concept, but had ways of incorporating this into daily life. And programs like Ma'o is reminding us of that and incorporating it in ways that we can live healthier and help our families to live healthier. And I think really, again, having health by improving health in our communities, which is, I think, a shared kuleana, is an important part of just the Hawaiian experience.
That was Alika Monakea, an assistant professor at the University of Hawaii. He was talking about an epigenetics research project on the Leeward Coast. They start with students involved with Mau Farms and then reach out to their family and friends to take part in the survey, helping to build a database to help understand the relationship of genes and the environment. We have links where you can find more on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kapono from the band Jamarek, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
On the slopes of Mauna Loa, you can find an endangered endemic Hawaiian seabird protected by a 5-mile, $1 million fence. The fence is needed to protect this bird from feral cats, even at 10,000 feet above sea level. Construction workers could only work on the fence from January to May because they didn't want to disturb this bird's breeding season. They returned to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park briefly in April to prepare nest sites and return in early June to lay a single egg. Due to the remoteness of the location, construction equipment and staff had to be flown in and out of the site each day. This protected endemic species is one of many that earned Hawaii Volcanoes National Park its World Heritage Site designation in 1987, and scientists have been studying them consistently since 1990. Now, with the help of remote game camera, scientists can see the Hawaiian petrel as they come and go at night.
And Sherry Cohen of Waiahu, Maui, was the first of several callers. We got lots of calls about petrels, but today's species was Pterodroma sandwichensis, and Sherry knew that. She's our winner, and if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you hear this music, does it make you optimistic about love or give you cold feet?
Lots of people argue that having these high expectations is problematic and it's harming the institution of marriage.
How marriage became so high stakes.
Most of what we think of as traditional marriage was not traditional at all, but a rather recent invention.
And what we can do to fix it on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
Andy Kimball tells his story with voice and guitar, drawing on the techniques that have sustained itinerant blues artists for generations. For the fingerstyle guitarist, the instrument is a portable orchestra with bass lines, chords, and fragments of melody to support his vocals. Andy's coming to our Atherton studio this Saturday, and he sat down with us in our studio.
I started playing music about 9 years old, 10 years old, playing some guitar chords, basic guitar. I learned the guitar playing Monkey songs and the Weavers and Pete Seeger,
right,
back then. And then got to electric music and played mostly electric rock and roll for a long time. Fast forward later in life, my sister tried to get me to go to the Philadelphia Folk Festival and some other festivals on the East Coast, and at that time I pictured folk music as being where 5,000 people stand in a field and hold hands singing Kumbaya, and I figured, not for me. And then I started actually paying attention to some of the Canadian singer-songwriters, actually, like Stan Rogers, Garnett Rogers, John Gorka, some blues guys, Chris Smither, and I took such a liking to it that I decided that's what direction I want to go into, the acoustic music world. And lo and behold, that's what I ended up doing.
And in that world, as an acoustic guitar player, you're responsible for everything, right? You don't have a bass and drums, too. So you've got to generate bass lines, rhythm, chords, a little bit of
package.
Melody on top.
Yeah, I guess when I play, since I don't have the band, I the dynamics of a band. You know, the whole band is all about the dynamics.
Right,
how you gels together. I try to just instinctively, as part of me, create that dynamics with all I have, and just the guitar, that's all I have, and it just kind of happens.
Yeah.
So dynamics, I think, are a really important part. It's not just the notes. I mean, the notes are the notes, the chords are the chord shapes. But I think it's the dynamics that really create, you know.
If the volume doesn't rise and fall, the music gets boring really quickly.
Really quickly, yeah. And the energy level, the bringing it up, bringing it down.
Right.
And not doing it because, well, this is the part of the song where I bring it up, this is the part of the song where I bring it down. Because every single night playing the same song, those levels of dynamics completely different depending on what the room is asking for and what that, the mode of that audience. Is.
Well, you can draw the audience toward you by bringing the volume down, which
yes.
a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, and creating space and creating that silence. You don't have to play notes all the time. It's the silence and the space and how everything works together.
Well, I'm eager to hear you play something.
Let's do it. I want to do a song. I'll play an old Robert Johnson bass song, my version of it, and then I'll tell you about it after how I got to do this
right.
for the first time after I do it. We'll kick it off like this. One more time now. Well, I'll get up morning. If I want to dust my broom. Yeah, I'll get up morning, baby. If I want to dust my broom. I got something to tell you, baby. Ain't much time left to lose. Well, write me a letter, I'm gonna send it. Special telegram. Yeah, I'll write me a letter. Send a special gram. I'm gonna find me a woman, you're goddamn well, I am. Sing around guitar like this. I believe if my time ain't long. Yeah, I believe my time it ain't long. You gonna wake up some morning, you gonna find your good man. Well, I wanna call up China, see if my baby's over there. I wanna call up China, baby, see if my baby's over there. She's a fine little woman. I know she's in the world somewhere. One more time. Yeah, good morning, baby. Leave our dust, my broom. Yeah, good morning. If I want dust my broom, I got something to tell you. Ain't much time, I said I got something to tell you, baby. Ain't much time, I said I got something to tell you. One time like this. You got it. Too much time, baby. Time, baby. To lose.
Nice, Andy. I'm betting you do that song a little bit differently every time you do it.
It's always like what they call a crapshoot. Uh-oh, let's see if this works. Uh-oh, don't know quite where I'm going with it, but that's it.
Yeah, I was trying to, when you said you were going to do a Robert Johnson song, I was trying to anticipate which one it was. And it was, you know, Dust My Broom, which we know from Elmore James.
Elmore James, right.
Any number of other artists who've done it. But you know, a classic like a Robert Johnson song, and that didn't sound the way Robert Johnson played it at all.
Right.
I always feel that, that as part of the blues tradition, those songs become part of our, they're ours to take and interpret.
And dive into and have them become yours when you play them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, totally, totally. I think it's part of what the blues is.
I never tire of lyrics like, I'm going to call up China and see if my baby's over
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Yeah, something. When I first, I was telling you, when I first played that song, I think this may have been the first time I ever played it. I can, you know, I did different guitar riffs. I was offered to do a recording in a label in New Jersey. And I went in. I'd never been in a recording studio before. This whole thing was brand new to me. I couldn't believe I was actually doing this. And I get in a studio similar to what we're doing now in recording studio. And I started playing around, and they were doing audio and sound checks. Okay, go ahead. Let's hear something. And I played Dust My Broom, but I didn't know the song. These are not the original lyrics as he wrote them.
Right.
But so I played the song, just similar to what we just did. And they said, okay, great. Okay, let's set up the next one. I said, next one, what do you mean? Well, that was great, man. That's a take, right? And I was just checking out the tuning and the sound of the guitar.
You're basically doing a sound check.
I was doing a sound check. And they said, no, okay, that's okay, next song. I'm like, wow. And it ended up on the CD.
Well, that's the beauty of being a kind of a blues troubadour. You get to tell your story on any given night.
Yeah, right? yeah. It's fun. Fun time. Yeah,
that story changes.
Constantly. And part of the story, I think, is not just the story of that you create with the words, but what the music does. So the story can be interpreted differently by everybody sitting there who's sharing the experience with you.
Yeah.
So it's not just me shoving music, or a musician for that matter, shoving music down somebody's throat, or here's the song, here's how it's written, here's how it's going to go, and I expect you to sit there and listen to it. There's got to be an experience, a circuit that goes between the performer and the audience. I think that's what really makes a good show and a really rewarding experience for the audience and the musician. And most of the songs that are out there, I've got some recorded material, but a lot of the songs are one-and-done deals. I go on stage and pull a song out of the hat, and it gets recorded, and sometimes I'll hear these songs, and I say, you know, I really like that song, and to learn it, I've got to hear myself do it, because I couldn't repeat it at that moment.
Guitarist and singer Andy Kimball will perform in our Atherton studio this Saturday at 7:30, and you can find out more about it at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from UHM Kennedy Theatre, presenting Fights and Delights, three traditional Chinese comedies, opens 7:30 p.m. tomorrow, manoa.hawaii.edu/live-on-stage.
Each week, Says You, Public Radio's game of words and wit, attempts to present a seamless professional presentation with varying results.
Where are the words?
The words are downstairs.
This is not helpful.
This is an embarrassing moment.
Perhaps you can tell them when these shows will air, and then you won't have to do that.
A teaching moment.
Yes, a teaching moment. And I really don't know when these shows will air.
This evening at 6:30.
And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll sit down with a panel of experts to answer the question, how do we plan for and recover from disaster?
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your comments. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want to pass one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.